Welcome. You are listening to the UC Davis Center for Poverty Research Seminar Series. I'm the Center's Director, Ann Stevens. This series brings scholars and policy experts from around the country to discuss their work on poverty and poverty research. In February 2013, we hosted Ron Haskins, the Center's Winter Distinguished Visiting Scholar. He is co-director of the Brookings Center on Children and Families and the Budgeting for National Priorities Project. An expert on preschool, foster care, and poverty, Haskins was instrumental in the 1996 overhaul of national welfare policy. Here is Haskins presenting his seminar, Fighting Child Poverty, Spending So Much, Getting So Little.
This title is a little misleading for reasons I'll give in just a minute. I think it is true that we don't get enough out of our poverty programs, and we spend a tremendous amount of money, which you would not know reading. Especially, I love to pick on the New York Times, that we're always cutting programs and cutting them to the bone, down to the sinew, they said in one article I remember recently. So we spend a lot of money. What we don't get is prevention. So the government programs are surprisingly successful, and I'll show you how this operates in a few minutes, at reducing poverty rates. Our poverty rates would be much higher were it not for government programs. But we keep having more and more and more and more poor people, so in that sense, they've not been very successful. I forget what set of rules this is. I think we're doing anthropologist rules.
Economic rules is what we
think. Okay. So that means you can interrupt me. And within a few minutes, you'll want to interrupt me, I'm sure. All right, so here's an overview. My dad was a great speaker, unlike his son, and he always said to me, "Now, son, when you give a talk, tell them what you're going to say. Say it, then tell them what you said." So I follow two-thirds of that advice. I'm not going to summarize what I say. That's way more than I usually follow my dad's advice. All right, so trends in poverty and inequality, which will be very quick, and they're quite discouraging. Government spending on means-tested programs, which will also be quite quick. I just want to give you a snapshot of what we're actually spending and what the recent history has been and how we spend the money. And then I want to talk about pathways out of poverty and inequality, education. You know, this is very modern, sophisticated stuff. You know, you got to work, you got to have a good education, and you have to, it's better if your kids and you are from a married couple family. This is always a very popular topic on university campuses. People love to talk about how everybody ought to be married in order to raise their kids so they shouldn't get divorces, and above all, should not have kids outside marriage. People at university, this is fascinating to me. They have a fit over this, you know, blaming the victim and who are you to dictate and so forth. And yet almost all of them are married, and when they have kids, they're married, and they don't get divorces, especially college-educated women. I'll show you some data on that in a few minutes. All right, so that's what I'm going to talk about, unless you waylay me and want to talk about something else. All right, so here's the big picture on poverty. And these are black children. These are the elderly. And these are all children. So let me first of all impress upon you the data for the elderly. If we went back another few years, this would go even higher, above 50%. So we made this dramatic progress, and then it has been, you know, slower but still progress against the elderly. Now this is the official poverty measure, so there's some issues here, and we may want to have an argument or two about that in a few minutes. But if we actually account other benefits in here, then we can get under 8.7% for the elderly. So we're doing pretty well with the elderly. Now let's do black kids first. I just want to call your attention to this part right here, and I'm going to come back and talk more about that. That is progress against poverty right there. And much of it was achieved in the market, so I would call that prevention, and we'll talk about that. And it's somewhat controversial, and there have to be several people in this room who are going to, as they did last night at dinner and during the discussion yesterday, are going to object to say this is because of welfare reform in major part, and a lot of people don't like that. No, it's not welfare reform. I already see someone shaking their head, so we'll clash later. Good. All right, so now this is very controversial. I may say things that you don't like, but I like to acknowledge, you know, what the data source is and why I do it this way, and so we can discuss it if you would like to. So what this is the quintiles, divide the income distribution of FIS. So here's the bottom, here's the top, and then here's the top 1%. And this is income, average family income in 1979 and in 2007. Now, the most controversial part of this is how you define income. And a lot of you may be familiar with Pickett and Saez, and the New York Times and the New Republican, lots of and people in the Obama administration make a lot of their data. It's tax data, so there's a lot of income that is not included. And there is especially no consideration of household composition, which is a very big deal because the average household size has declined. So if you want to have an accurate measure of their how much resources people have compared to the composition of a household, then you have to take household size into account. If you do all those things and count the value of government benefits and subtract taxes, or in the case of the bottom two quintiles, if you add the income from taxation, that seems like a contradiction, but it's not, because we have what are called refundable tax credits in which the government sends you a check. I doubt anybody in this room is worthy of those kind of checks, but maybe you were in the past, or maybe you will be in the future. So the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit are a very important part, and they're often just left out of income. So and one more thing, health. How do we value health? If we value health at what is actually spent on you, then we have the bizarre situation where the sicker you are, the wealthier you are. So that's not a very good way to do it. And in these data, it's the insurance value of whatever health coverage you have counts as your income. This is a huge argument in Washington and around the country, and a lot of economists think, well, you shouldn't do that, especially liberal economists. They don't want to count a dollar of health as a dollar of income. And I think it should be counted as a dollar of income, and I always like to say that if we have a dollar of health benefits, we either tax someone for that dollar or we got it from the Chinese. So we pay a dollar for it, it ought to count as a dollar of income. And if it's not worth a dollar of income, then why are we making a public policy to cover people's health insurance? So we can talk more about it if you like to. The bottom line here is that if you do it this way, then all five quintiles have increased in income since 2007. That's the most controversial part, because a lot of people want to argue that that is not true, that the bottom is going to hell in a handbasket, the middle class is hollowing out, we're losing the middle class. Even the president has given speeches like this, the one in Osawatomie, I don't know if I said that right, but in Kansas. And many of his advisors talk that way, but as you can see here, if you define the middle as the middle 20% or even the middle 60%, income has increased. The worst part of this, in my estimation, is the inequality of income and how much that has exploded. And if we did this instead of the top 1%, if we did it the top 0.01% or the top 0.001%, then the ceiling here is not tall enough. For some reason, the American economy has produced zillionaires, and lots of them. There's a recent article, I haven't read it yet, it just came out, not article, but study by the Congressional Research Service, which is a highly reputable organization. I can tell you, just as an aside here, the Green Book, of course, is by far the most reliable source of information from Washington. But the three organizations we have in Washington, and I really, this to me is a miracle, because Washington, maybe some of you worked in Washington, but if you haven't, you have no idea how partisan Washington is and all the slimy, rotten, crummy things do to people. Mark Twain said, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. There's a fourth category, which is Washington use of statistics, which is even worse. So the Congressional Budget Office, the Congressional Research Service, and even defying credulity, the Office of Management and Budget, which is directly part of the Office of the President, all three of those organizations are very reliable. They publish very reliable information, often super sophisticated analyses. I always used to say about the analysts at CBO and CRS that they're like full professors without the attitude. That's pretty good. I thought maybe someone would throw some at me in university. That line is very popular in Washington, by the way. All right, so we have inequality problems for sure. And many of you probably know this was a lot of politicians in Washington. They seem mostly to be from the Republican Party. Denied this for years. You know, it's kind of hard to look at this right here and deny the growth of inequality, but it can be done, especially in Washington. So I just want to... The main thing that I want to say to you is, and I'm going to show you this in more detail. In fact, I think I can do it in the next slide if my memory is good. Oh, no. First, I want to make an admission, another one that Republicans are reluctant to admit, And that is, we pride ourselves as being a land of opportunity, a lot of mobility in the United States. You work hard, you get ahead, and so forth. So here are the correlations. A guy from Canada named Miles Corrick, who is really a wonderful researcher, does these data. And he has data on income of fathers and sons in all these countries. And it's simply the correlation of the fathers and sons' income. So the higher they are correlated, the less mobility you have. And as you can see, the United States is far ahead. So the apple falls the closest to the tree in the United States. This is not big-time mobility. We have a problem with mobility. Now, there's another argument here. We can get into this if you'd like to, about whether we have more now than we had before or less now than we had before. There are lots of claims about less. I don't think that's necessarily true. I believe this has always been, we've always stood out in this way. And here you can see it's the English-speaking countries. I often suggest that we should have a new language in the United States, and that might help our mobility problem. And if we had include Australia and New Zealand in here, same thing. It really is the English-speaking countries that have this high, have lower mobility and a bigger dispersion of income. So we are not the leader in mobility in the world, that's for sure. What?
And less of a safety.
Well, I'm not going to concede that yet. All right, so now I'm going to talk for the rest of the time about poverty and inequality and my explanation of what we should, what causes it, and the kind of things that we could think about that would offset poverty and inequality. And I'm well aware that there are people in this room who know a lot more about poverty than I do, so I'm going to try to be humble. It may not seem like it, but I am aware of that. Let me confess that at the beginning. So I mainly say that just in case they decide that they're going to get into it with me, that they'll at least start out with a good attitude. I'm referring especially to you. All right, so what is the problem? Well, how come we can't make more progress on poverty and inequality? And here are my favorite reasons. I'm sure there are other reasons. The last one I'm going to say one word about, because you know everybody wants to be out of here at 1:30. Work rates are a big part of the problem. Wages are a big part of the problem. Family composition, education, and then these other factors. I'll just say one thing about immigration, and hopefully we're going to do something. Immigration would be relatively easy to do something about. These are back of the envelope, but I think probably we could lower our poverty rate by maybe a half a percentage point, which that's a lot, if we change our immigration policy. I think that that immigrants add about a half a percentage point. Now, our immigrant situation is really, it's kind of strange, because it's helpful to think of it as bimodal. We have a lot of low-income immigrants, low-skilled, poorly educated, especially from Mexico. They're very important to our economy. If you don't believe that, try to figure out a way to stop the flow. The simple way to do it, and we could do this, especially if we had a national ID, is to find employers that hire them. And if we had a national ID, it'd be a fairly easy thing to do. Republicans are really opposed to that for one simple reason. Small business are, 90% of small businessmen are Republicans. It might even be higher than that. They're very influential in the Republican Party, and small businessmen don't like that because they can hire people cheaply, and they don't want to have a good system. So it adds some political problems here for trying to do something about it. But if we had a different immigration problem, a selection method to bring immigrants into the country like many other countries do, and we would admit a much higher fraction of immigrants based on their education or their skills or their employment, that would be very helpful. They still would like to come to the United States. Similarly, we would have a much better program for allowing students to stay here once they finish their degrees. So we do have a world competition for high-quality immigrants that can contribute to an economy, are unlikely to commit crimes, and so forth. And we're losing that because our system is so junky, and because we really don't try to do it. That is very much on the table in Washington. I think there is bipartisan agreement on this point. And right now, family relationship is probably the single most important factor in immigration policy. And what we would do is we would adjust that and reduce the importance of family relationships and increase the importance of skills and work experience and education. And that we'd have immigrants that would be more skilled and higher educated, and it would be good for the economy, and it would be good for poverty and for inequality. So that's all I'm going to say about immigration, and somebody wants to bring it up. So government spending, I have one chart here that I want to call to your attention. This has two measures. First, it has spending per person in poverty. This is all in constant dollars. And this is spending on the 10 biggest programs. So we actually spend more than this. If anybody's interested, I testify about this to the Budget Committee in the House of Representatives and go into all the details. I think that we spend about $1 trillion a year and increasing every year on means-tested programs, on all the programs. I'll show you how they're categorized in just a minute. And it increases almost every year. So we are spending a lot of money on means-tested programs. It might be less in European countries, but they set a very high standard that we've caught up with them dramatically over the years. This is about ready to stop. I think we can get into that, too. This little downturn here, by the way, in spending per person in poverty, we actually spent way more money in this year than previous years, but our poverty rate went up so much as a result of the Great Recession that the numerator just could not keep up. Yes?
How much of that approximately is healthcare spending? So I'm just wondering if this is moving way above Medicare.
That's a really important point to compare to other countries. They have national health insurance, so
right.
That's not in there in a comparison.
Right, right. There's several issues. You know, Garfinkel and Rainwater and Smeeding wrote this book a couple of years ago. I was surprised because they're all kind of way left of center, and yet I thought it was really a spectacular treatment, and they conclude, especially include education,
right.
That the U.S. is not, you know, we're in the same ballpark. We don't spend as much as them, but we're in the same ballpark. Anyway, okay, this is very important, and I'm going to talk about health care several times during this discussion. I think we spend way too much money on health care. We spend way more money than any other nation in the world. And I feel entitled to say we spend too much because other nations spend less and get better results. I mean, that's kind of a good definition, spending too much. We should be able to spend less and get better results than we get now. And there are all kinds of reasons. I hadn't intended to say this often, embarrass myself because I think of something and I want to say it, but then I can't remember. So Atul Gawande. Anybody recognize that name?
Yeah.
An amazing economist. He has an article. He's an MD. He has an article in probably the New Yorker. It compares McAllen, Texas, and I think El Paso. And it is such a shocking article because huge differences in per capita spending in Medicare or health insurance in general in these two communities because of the difference in the way doctors are organized and how they bill. It seems like a boring topic, but I mean, it's about half as much in, I think, in El Paso compared to McAllen. I highly recommend this article, Gawande, G-U-W-A-N-D-E, is that right? Someone can correct me. But here what you can see is this is all means-tested spending. I should have emphasized this before, especially for students who have not studied American social policy. This does not include the insurance programs. Insurance programs are a category unto themselves, so, and especially Medicare, Social Security, and unemployment insurance. Those are not represented in anything I'm showing you here. These are all means-tested programs. Many of them are entitlement programs, which means that you have to get the benefit if you meet the qualification, and some of them are appropriated programs that are not guaranteed. So like housing, child care, many other programs, a specific amount is appropriated every year. It has to be appropriated every year or it cannot be spent. And so that means the Congress has to review it every year. And those are the programs that are likely to get cut as compared with the big entitlement programs that they not only don't get cut, they don't get reviewed. They're just on automatic pilot. They grow and grow and grow. So we spend most of our means-tested money on health programs or 11 different programs. And as you can see down here, we spend this money in 8 categories. This is done, by the way, by a Congressional Research Service. Hardly any of my charts they're nothing I did. I'm way too partisan to be doing charts, so I just want to reassure you that I think my charts are mostly... All right, this is the way the world is supposed to work. And this is from the Green Book, and Wendell Primus, who invented the Green Book, and Democrats lost the election in 1994, so Republicans took over, and I took over the Green Book. Wendell and I are very good friends, so I consulted with Wendell. And there were several things that he should have had in the Green Book that he didn't. He might be a little partisan, too. So we put some things in the Green Book that I think are really important, including things like this. Now, Wendell did have things like this in the Green Book. They're very creative, and they're done by, I think this one was done by both the Congressional Budget Office and HHS. So here's what it shows. This is life in the state of nature, so to speak. What would be the poverty rate in female-headed families if there were no government programs, no taxes, and no transfers? And the answer is be almost 40%. All right. So now we break down the gifts that we give to people into two categories. The ones that do not come through the tax codes, so this would be programs like housing and food stamps. And that reduces, and cash programs like TANF and SSI. And that reduces SSI as Supplemental Security Income. It's a program for elderly and disabled. You have to be poor and either elderly or disabled to get SSI. And that brings the poverty rate down very substantially, about 20% to 29.9%, and then it comes down again when we include the tax benefits like the Earned Income Tax Credit. And the total poverty reduction is 34%, so this is why I was saying to you that I think it's an extremely important thing to keep in mind that government programs really do reduce the poverty rate. They don't prevent poverty too well, although I'll show you something in a minute that may. I have a second version of this that we're going to see toward the end, and it's actually is kind of the thesis that I would present about preventing poverty, and that will stir up some discussion, so I'm going to save that till the end. Now, this is correlational. This is not, I'm not making a causal argument here, but this is kind of interesting. It's Bell Sawhill did this first, you know, maybe 10 years ago, and we've updated it several times. I think this is the original version because the numbers got out there and we didn't want to change the numbers. They changed slightly from year to year. So this is a fairly straightforward idea here, and that is let's take the national population as represented in the current population survey. Let's change one thing at a time and see what effect that would have on the poverty rate, and then let's change all those things and see what effect that would have on the poverty rate. So, for example, what would happen if everybody worked full-time at whatever wage they make now? If they don't work, then attribute to them the wage that's equivalent to the average person with that education. And the answer is poverty rate would decline 42%. Marriage. This is a marriage rate. We randomly put people together and marry them inside the computer. This is a miracle of modern computers. And match them only on race, and there's a kind of an age factor in there, and poverty would decline 27% if we did that. Now, this is not everybody married. This is the marriage rate that we actually had in the 1970s, so it makes it a little more realistic. What about education? If everybody had just a high school education, it would reduce poverty 15%, reduce family size 13%, double cash welfare. This is not going to happen in our lifetime. This is not going to happen in God's lifetime. 8%. So this will give you some idea if we increase welfare payments, it won't necessarily have a huge impact. So if you were just a naive graduate student, for example, and you saw these data, you might say, well, gosh, if I want to reduce poverty, maybe I should try to produce more work, more marriage, and get people to stay in school longer. That's what kind of strategy we ought to have. So this is a naive way that we do things in Washington. All right, so let's talk. Oh, yes.
Before you leave that, when you had your original list of strategies in this, I think it raises this question of, I mean, it's interesting to think about these single measures and how much they would do, but it strikes me that the real possibilities for changing things are about the interactions between these bars.
Right.
That is, if we could do something about work opportunities, that might change marriage rates and reduce cash welfare. And so I think, while this is sort of, these numbers are interesting, I think it's important to emphasize that they're also interconnected.
Right. Right, I do too. I think I should invite you to the rest of my talks because you're actually strengthening my point. Let me give you one example. This, to me, is an amazing example. There is a program, I'm going to show you later, a list of programs for children that were evaluated with random assignment experiments often multi-sites, and, you know, really good social science research. And one of them is called career academies. And the basic idea of career academies is, first of smaller schools, but the real essence of it is that the kids have an experience in the business world, and they do it year after year after year. They don't necessarily work, but they have something like a mentor, and they go to a work site, and the idea is that they're learning, oh, you got to be there on time, you have to show up, you have to get along with your peers, you have to take orders, and this is the kind of stuff they learn. All right, no impacts on women. Oh, by the way, 8 sites, this is really a wonderful study, MDRC, 8 sites, and no effects on women, but really profound effects on guys. Follow them over 8 years, and they make more than $2,000 per year on average in those 8 years. And here comes my point, this is why I'm going, you know, running my mouth here, is that they have a 16% higher rate of living with their children, and also a higher marriage rate. So, and I already thought this, so now this, I often cite this because it really reinforces what I think is a big part of the decline in marriage in the United States, which is men's income. Now, there are other reasons, but men's income, and I'll show you some data in just a minute, that we do have a real problem with men's income. So, yes, there are definitely interactions. Yes?
Quickly, is that increased marriage really just, are you talking about marriage, or are you talking about dual income?
Well, if you increase the marriage rate, you increase the proportion of families that have dual income. Yeah. They add.
But this is, why not put dual income family formations instead of marriage per se?
Because I want to convince people that we need higher marriage rates in the United States. Jesus. All right, so education. What? Education. This is an amazing chart, I think. It goes all the way back to 1963. Here are high school dropouts, high school degree, some college but no degree, a four-year degree or two-year degree, and advanced degree. These lines never touch. So marriage has always been a good strategy for someone who wants to have more money, and this is in the prime earning years, family income. But notice the patterns now. Look how much space is between these now. They're separating. This is a nice example of why of the education is more and more important in America for accounting for income. And also notice the direction. The only increases is with a four-year over the last two decades or so is with a four-year degree and with a graduate degree. Even a high school degree, you make less and less and less every year, and the high school dropout even less. And even with some college, you're still not having increasing wages. So this is why this shows education is really a crucial factor. And here's one that's even more impressive to me. Now, this is kind of complicated. This is based on a panel study of income dynamics, which is amazing, amazing. You know, you can tell a graduate student that's really going to be a good social scientist because they see wonderful data sets and they go, oh, wow, what a great data set, you know. Well, that's the way you should feel about PSID. They started collecting data when 5,000 families in the 1960s. They followed them. They're still following them. And then they followed their kids. So this allows us to compare the kids' income with their own parents during the primary earning years. All these data points are 5 years income average, which greatly stabilizes income, and compare the kids with the parents. Okay, so for example, and this is divided in half. These are kids without a college degree. These are kids with a college degree. So here are the parents in the bottom 20%. Where are their kids? And the answer is 45% of them are in the bottom 20%. What about the top? Only 3%. Of the parents with the bottom income in the bottom quintile, only 3% of those kids make it all the way to the top, all right? Now look over here with a college degree. Oh, so the conclusion you can draw from this, and, you know, I wish I'd known you when you were younger because then it would make some difference. You got to choose your parents carefully. If you don't do that, you're asking for trouble. You might have a 45% chance rather than a 20% chance of winding up at the bottom. Now, the same kids from the bottom 20%, here they are, if they get a college degree. How many of you have ever heard about a random assignment experiment that produces impacts by a factor of 4? I mean, this is really a powerful effect. So if a kid from the bottom quintile can get a 4-year degree, they cut by 75%, a little more, their chances of being in the bottom. And look at the top, only 3% here, 10% here. So education is really, really important. And in our lifetime, we'll never see better data than this to answer this question, I think. I mean, this is really amazing data. Selection all over the side. I said correlational. I mean, I'm not. But it isn't all selection, I don't think. But we could argue about that if you want to. Yes. Oh.
Which, and it's,
are you guys in cahoots, or what? How does this work?
We're both economists.
Yeah. Drank the same.
People are trading.
So I guess I would just re-emphasize what Colin said by saying I think it's great that you're putting forward that these are just correlations, but then you did just conclude that education is the path.
Okay.
The path,
all right.
Right.
All right. So your conclusion from correlational data is that you can never make any kind of causal statement. You can't even say this suggests or anything like that. Would you look at these data and realize they're correlational, and would you tell your children, of course, this is all a figment because it's only correlational, so don't worry about going to college?
I would be very cautious about what I would conclude.
Okay.
I would say maybe education plays a role, or maybe something else that's correlated with education.
Well, I think, here's what I think you should say. You should say education and lots of other things play a role. I mean, I think this suggests there are, education plays a role. You can't look at this and think education doesn't play any role. Can you look at that and say it doesn't play any role? Anyway, we made the point here that it's not causal. Okay, you're going
to
even add.
It's just extraordinarily hard to determine causality in these mm-hmm. situations. In our hearts, we're in education. We really want to believe that education.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We actually do believe it. At the same time, we don't see very much data, you know, hard data that can really say for sure that's
the case. Yeah, okay. I subscribe to that statement. So I stand corrected, y'all. I still think education is super important. All right, so with data like this, economists would predict that if young Americans would realize, oh my God, it pays, even if they listen to economics professors. The odds are that if I get an education, that it really makes a big difference. And America as a country would focus on our schools, and we would really make sure the kids are learning that. So here's data from the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which I widely accepted as a highly reliable, maybe the most reliable set of performance data. And as you can see, these are like a carpenter's dream. We are not doing better in reading. We're not doing better in math. And not only that, other countries are. We're out of 64 countries. This is from the PISA. Tied for 24th in math. Tied for 19th in science, and so forth. And these remarkable countries that are ahead of us. So either based on improvement over time in our education or on international comparisons, we have a long ways to go. We're not doing well on either K-12 or maybe even post-secondary. That's a little more doubtful, but definitely K-12. So there are a lot of investments we could make. I'm not going to go through each one of these, but in our book that you mentioned, Creating an Opportunity Society, we do go into some detail on these. And there's good data from random assignment, not just correlational, for most of these interventions. Preschool, I ought to mention just briefly, because the president mentioned his speech. It's a great lesson about what Washington is like and the influence that Washington has on the whole country, never mind what Americans say, how much they hate Washington. So we all know people that spend their life going around trying to convince legislators and American public about how important preschool is. They give speeches, they write op-eds and so forth. And no one pays much attention to them. I know this because I've been doing it most of my adult life. The president has one line in his State of the Union address, and the country explodes. There are articles everywhere about preschool. Even Jim Heckman comes out of the woodwork and makes all kinds of claims about the Perry Preschool, a program that was operated about 500 years ago. And what?
Or 67 or something.
Yeah, well, it's approximately, I said. I think the president said two things that were, by implication at least, wrong. Number one is he said universal. I think it might have been a mistake in the speech. I just can't believe that people at HHS or others would have said that. Given our financial problems, and we're going to spend money on putting kids in preschool who are from families that earn $250,000, this is nuts. We're not going to do that. We're not going to do it. So what could he have been talking about? And the other problem is he wasn't clear about what he proposes. Apparently what they have in mind, I've talked to some people in administration since the speech and even a little bit before, I think what they want to do is they want the states to have more control, including of Head Start money. So I think they may be looking for a way. Many of you probably already know this, but states spend something like on the order, I think it's $7 billion on their state pre-K programs, and Head Start is about $7 billion. And in some states, they work together. They're pretty well coordinated, but other states, they don't work together at all. So you've got two completely separate programs with more or less the same goal. It's just not a way to, you know, run a country. So I think that there's room here for, we could get a bigger bang for the buck if we had better coordination, and I think that's maybe what the president has in mind. I don't see how he's going to get more money out of the federal government or out of the states unless he's prepared to cut programs. Now, he has consistently said, we should talk about this a little bit, he has consistently said from his first inaugural address that his view of government is cut things that don't work and spend money, more money on things that do work. I think you could make an argument that preschool programs, high-quality preschool programs, do work. They do have an impact on kids. It's very much up in the air about how big that impact is. It's certainly up in the air about Head Start, whether that really produces an average impact, and certainly how long it lasts. But we have lots of good studies of preschool, including state pre-K programs, which could even be, I mean, it is better. That data is better than Head Start data. So this is probably a worthwhile investment. But here's the bottom line, and this also he did not say, and it drives me nuts because politicians never say this. They talk about preschool like it's one unified thing. All preschool is the same. It's all high quality, and it will all produce impacts. That is false. If you don't have high quality preschool, which I think means a very skilled teacher, you are not going to produce impacts. So our problem is not just digging up the money. Our problem is figuring out how to organize a preschool system that features high quality teachers all around the country. And we're now paying some of them, you know, like $15,000. So there's a lot of work to do here to create a high-quality preschool system. And I know that's what the president, that's the direction he wants to take us. It just was not very clear in the State of the Union. The other thing I want to say about the Obama administration, the last two administrations have been really focused on K-12 education. I think No Child Left Behind didn't necessarily work out too well. There are lots of education experts in this room, so I'm not going to make too many claims here. But I do think that the Obama administration has done some really, really smart things on especially I-3. I-3 stands for Investing in Innovation. It was almost $700 million. And here are the two things. I think this is very important, and it has a much broader message for government programs. First, in applying for the money, it's competitive, okay? The worst thing you can do is have grants that are given to states based on population or whatever, because they, Nevada can submit a perfectly awful proposal and get whatever proportion of money is theirs. Most federal grants should be competitive, because then you can pick and choose based on some criterion, if it's an open process and so forth. I think that's the way we should go. And that's the way the Obama administration did go on I-3. It's competitive, and they specified very clearly what they wanted, and especially, get this, they want evidence that what you're going to do is going to work. And they especially want, believe it or not, random assignment evidence. I've conducted in the last 18 months or so 130 interviews, or my assistant and I have, 130 interviews of administration officials, congressional staffers, and advocates in Washington. And they all talk about random assignment. Some of them don't like it very much. But it's fascinating that, again, the power of the presidency to alert everybody about what's really important, and if data's important, correlations don't cut it, right? Did you just tell me that a minute ago? So it's fascinating, and not only that, but then all of the programs that get the money have to agree to high-quality evaluations, including some random assignment. Now, this raises a huge issue. I'm just going to stick this in here. Someone may want to talk about it later. we really have a technology problem here. We want to have programs that have strong evidence of success, but not all our programs can have strong evidence of success because you have innovation. And by definition, you don't yet have good evidence if it's going to work. So you always want to leave some room for innovation. The administration has, I think, solved this problem by giving most of the money to programs that have a lot of evidence of success, including random assignment, but they leave money for programs that are innovative and have promise, so a logic model or associated studies that are a little bit different. It's just a wise way to go. They're doing this in several. They have six of these evidence-based initiatives, by the way, five in addition to I3. And so the first thing is you have to have evidence of success for most of the money. And then the next thing is you have to agree to evaluation. So you get something both, and oh, I want to say, this is remarkable for people who study evidence because the evidence is on the inside from the very beginning. Normally, I have a chart that I use. It's a pie chart, and it shows all the factors that influence decisions that Congress makes and the President signs a bill. Well, what are they considering? Well, they're considering party philosophy. They're considering the position of the chairman. You know, there are a whole bunch of factors, and then there's a little teeny slice evidence. And that's the way it usually is. So you have, you know, 11 people in the world who are fighting like mad to try to get evidence to be a part of a decision in a congressional process. You have the same thing at state level, you have the same thing at city level, you have the same thing in the public schools. People that think we ought to base our decisions much more on evidence, and especially high quality evidence.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.